The title of tonight's talk is The Practice of Recollection. Sometimes this practice of insight meditation is called the practice of recollection. Why is it called this? There are two reasons. One is because although it is easy to be mindful, it's actually, as we know already, quite difficult at times to remember to be mindful. And another way of putting this is that although it's effortless to actually be mindful, it takes a lot of effort to remember. So that's one reason. Another reason why this is called the practice of recollection is that we are recollecting ourselves. There's a gathering together that is occurring. So this is the second reason. And I'd like to speak about both of these areas tonight, both aspects of this particular practice being called the practice of recollection. The first being that it's easy to be mindful means that it's not complicated. It's actually utterly simple to be mindful. You know, when we break the word down, mindfulness, of course, it's a fullness of mind. And another way of putting it, if it sounds too mind-oriented or thought-oriented, is that it's a wholeness of heart. You know, so it's bringing the full mind or the whole heart to whatever it is that we're experiencing. And I think one of the key words is just, meaning whatever we're experiencing, whatever activity we're engaged in, that's just what we're doing. So when we're eating, we're just eating. You know, I was speaking earlier today about walking and leaving off the and part. Walking and worrying, walking and remembering, regretting, planning, etc., etc. So it's just doing whatever it is that we're doing. We're not adding or subtracting to our experience in any way. When we're eating, we're just eating. When we're walking, we're just walking. When we're sitting, we're just sitting. When we're talking, we're just talking. Oh no. I think I rhymed that. Oh, well. We are really just doing whatever it is that we're doing. So in that way, it's easy. You know? We're just letting go of the unnecessary. We're letting go of the extra. We are noticing what's happening with a non-judgmental observation. You know? So we're being aware without judging our experience. Because that's where the extra comes in. That's where the and comes in. Oftentimes, whatever it is that we're doing, we're judging it as we're doing it, as being good or bad or this or that, so on and so forth. So we are experiencing our life without judging and without commenting, without adding. Mindfulness is also being present without a personal agenda. So this is the difference between ordinary attentiveness and mindfulness. In ordinary attentiveness, there is very much a personal agenda. I want things to go this way, so I'm picking and choosing what I'm going to be aware of. Certainly there is awareness in ordinary attentiveness. You know? But it has a goal in mind, and it's a personally selected goal. You know, it's not what is, we're not being aware of everything. We're being aware of what I want so that I can get. You know? So it's very personal in that way. And meditative awareness or mindfulness is awareness for the sake of liberation. Awareness for the sake of awareness, so without any sense of personal agenda. Now, of course, We could be mindful of our personal agendas because we have them, and we don't need to judge them or think that we shouldn't have them. And at the same time, we can allow them to be let go of for the sake of living a wider and more vast life. You know, something that embraces everything, not just what we think we have to have in order to be happy. So often we're wrong anyway about what we think we have to have in order to be happy. So it's easy to be mindful, and it's hard, it's difficult to remember. What are we remembering? Yeah. Other than what I just described, what are we remembering? I'd like to read you a poem by Naomi Shaheb Nye called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees. The monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. So this is what we're remembering. We're remembering trees, the monastery bell at twilight. We're remembering the rain. We're actually remembering how to stay awake in the midst of this life. How to stay open and sensitive, aware of all of our sense doors. We are remembering what is most important. You know, at its basic level, this is what mindfulness is remembering what our priorities are. Oftentimes, this is one of the great values of a retreat. You know, that gradually, over the course of being here together and simply being silent and sitting and walking and listening deeply, our priorities, our deeper sense of what is meaningful for us, of what we really want in this life, our deepest aspirations, tend to float to the surface, and we see them more clearly. And then in seeing them more clearly, we can actually begin to embody them. So we are remembering what is most important, what is most meaningful for us. We're remembering what our hearts truly yearn for. Yeah? And it's not to imitate what someone else's heart yearns for. And it's not to adopt any kind of belief system about what we should yearn for. Now, it's listening so deeply that we really hear what our hearts are truly yearning for. And what we tend to pick up on is what you could call an ancient echo. Now, that which has been there forever, which we have ignored and not paid a whole lot of attention to. So we begin to almost vibrate to this ancient echo that is long forgotten, and yet not completely forgotten, because here we are. Basically, we are remembering true nature. We are remembering who we already are. Now, in this particular culture, And one does get the sense that this was different than in the Buddhist time. Some things are totally the same, and some things are a little bit different. In this particular culture, many of us have been brought up with the idea of original sin. You know, it's kind of been inbred into us because of our early childhood, and just even if we haven't had a religious upbringing, it's kind of in the air around us. Yeah? And actually, what the Buddhist teachings are it's so very, very different. It's actually the opposite of original sin. The idea is to try to have some degree of faith in our original goodness. Yeah? And not conventionally speaking, not now I need to try to be good and fit in some way, but actually having trust in inner goodness. Not only, of course, in our own, but in everyone's. You know, that fundamental to every human being is this inner goodness. Of course, there is so much on top of this. And so not to dismiss this or ignore this in ourselves or in others. You know, not to be naive. But it is not naive to trust in original goodness instead of in original sin. And it's actually quite a huge difference, yeah, that the Buddha saw for himself and offered to us than this cultural belief that we may have. So in a sense, we are remembering this inner goodness so that we can live it. And it is quite a leap at times. Now, because of what we've learned. So over and over again, I think it's an invitation, practice is an invitation to remember. We are being reminded by this environment. On this retreat, we're being reminded by the environment around us, especially because of the simplicity. You know, we don't have our usual things around us. We can't just go in the refrigerator on our own and pull out what we want. When the phone rings, it's not for you. You know? Sometimes we feel the loss of that, but it's actually quite a wonderful thing as well. You go back to your room, there's not going to be a note for you, or messages, or email, or anything that we're called upon to do other than to be aware and awake. You know, so just the simplicity of the environment is really such a wonderful reminder of what's important. I'd like to read you a poem by Genzai, and it's called Poem Without a Category. Trailing my stick, I go down to the garden edge. Call to a monk to go out the pine gate. A cup of tea with my mother, looking at each other, enjoying our tea together. In the deep lanes, few people in sight. The dog barks when anyone comes or goes. Fall floods have washed away the planks of the bridge. Shouldering our sandals, we wade the narrow stream. By the roadside, a small pavilion where there used to be a little hill. It helps out our hermit mood. Country poems pile one sheet on another. I dabble in the flow, delighted by the shallowness of the stream. Gaze at the flagging, admiring how firm the stones are. The point in life is to know what's enough. Why envy those otherworld immortals? With the happiness held in one inch square heart, you can fill the whole space between heaven and earth. With the happiness held in one inch square heart, you can fill the whole space between heaven and earth. In this environment, being reminded of inner contentment because of the simplicity, because of not having what our usual props are, our usual things that we think we have to have. We are also reminded, of course, by the forms, the ancient forms of sitting and of walking. Now, every time we come into the hall and we sit again, and it's actually quite helpful to leave off the again part. This is where we get fatigued and disturbed and start to go a little bit crazy. But to come in and sit and to recognize that everyone else is sitting as well is such a remarkable reminder. Just the posture itself of sitting is amazing. Because when we're sitting, we are reminded that we can be still. We are reminded that whatever the mind is doing, we do not have to cooperate with that which is not going to serve. Yeah? In other words, there's a certain degree of equanimity innate in the posture of sitting. Because the posture is that of stillness, of not moving, according to our likes and our dislikes, our preferences, our viewpoints, our loves, and our aversions. We're sitting still through the beauties and through the storms, through whatever way the weather is, whether it's raining or whether it's sunny or whether it's cloudy, or whether there are, you know, cumulus clouds. I used to love those. That's the only one I remembered when I was growing up, was the cumulus one. You know, whether there are those kind of billowing kinds of clouds. Whatever way the weather is, we are sitting through it all. And this in of itself is a remarkable reminder of what is possible. And we touch in inner strength. Even when we find ourselves pushed around by what the mind is doing, by what our emotions are doing, simply by sitting still and not moving in accordance to what our mind is telling us, there is an incredible reminder to ourselves that is occurring. In the walking, it's the same, because we're not walking anywhere. We're walking back and forth. And people would say that this is a crazy thing to do, to walk back and forth. You know, what are you getting done? What are you accomplishing? You know? And yet, we understand simply by walking back and forth that in each step we are understanding peace. We are understanding contentment. We are actually vibrating to the rhythm of life in walking back and forth. When we relate to it as walking back and forth, that's when we're sunk. And then we think, oh my God, I have to do this for another half an hour, walk back and forth. You know, but actually in the moment of it, being sensitive and awake in the moment of it, it's really just the foot touching the floor and really just that sensation that becomes quite compelling after a while. You know, just the sensation of the foot touching the floor, or recognizing the feeling of the air on our skin. You know, this kind of thing that seems so insignificant actually becomes everything, all we need, because we realize more and more that our life consists of what is happening right here and right now. You know, that really and truly this is it. And so we are awake to this moment. We're awake to the present through the forms of sitting and of walking. We are also reminded in this environment by the silence, simply agreeing with one another, and it is indeed an agreement, to not talk. We are reminded by not talking of inner silence as well. The outer silence reminds us of the inner silence. Attempting to refrain from talking to ourselves, commenting, describing from moment to moment what we're doing. Sometimes one finds that one doesn't talk to oneself that much, but engages in dialogue with someone else who isn't here. You know, talking on and on, blow by blow, you know, every moment of what is happening so that you can report it when you go home. Of course, it's not going to happen. The person's eyes are going to glaze over in boredom. But we're interested. You know, we're interested in talking. And so we're interested in this inner dialogue, even if the other person may not be. Yeah? And the encouragement is not to judge these inner dialogues or to judge the times that we are talking to ourselves, but as well to see the value of listening. And when we let go of talking to ourselves or to another, it leaves a space within our minds, within our hearts, so that we can listen more deeply. And out of this listening more deeply, we can learn, we can understand, and it really is out of understanding that liberation and peace occur. We are also reminded by the instructions. Sometimes on a retreat we hear many, many different instructions, but in essence, the instructions are to come back to ourselves over and over again, finding ourselves far afield, finding ourselves all over the place, even though really we're just right here. The instructions are always to come back to ourselves. The instructions are to be a lamp unto oneself. You know, to be receptive to the help that is available, the guidance that is available, the love that is available. And at the same time, remembering that mindfulness is deeply empowering. It really is a refuge. So, over and over again, being a lamp unto ourselves. The way we are lamps unto ourselves is by trusting in awareness. Over and over again, trusting in awareness instead of placing our trust in that which comes and goes, which is everything that is conditioned. This is generally where we place our faith and our trust. And everything is changing. Because of this, it's not a great place to land. Now, so instead, the instructions are always to trust in awareness. Each time we remember to be awake, to be aware, to be mindful, it becomes a little bit easier to remember. And this is why the practice moves from being one of great effort to that which is effortless, is because it really truly does become easier to be mindful, to remember to be mindful with each moment of remembering to be mindful. You know, it kind of conditions another moment of remembering to be mindful. We are in the process of turning around our habit of forgetting, our habit of abandoning ourselves, our habit of being lost in thought. And sometimes it's just a very slow turnaround, and so we have to be quite patient. Why is it so very hard to remember to be mindful? Well, one reason is because we've been going in pretty much of a mindless direction for an awfully long time. Now, if we look at just when we began to practice, however long ago that might be. Certainly, for many of us, we lived a lot of life before we began the practice. However young one was, one has lived a certain amount of life. And so our habit, our conditioning, is to forget, you know, is to not be awake and aware. But another point, perhaps, when I say going in a mindless direction for a long time, perhaps we've been going in a mindless direction for a very long time because the Buddha said that ignorance is beginningless, which is just one of those things one likes to throw out because it boggles one's mind. What does that mean, beginningless? I have no idea. But it certainly gives one a sense that perhaps forgetting has been happening for a very long time. Ignoring how things are, being disconnected from nature. And I think sometimes when we hear this, being disconnected from nature, we think of the times we live in today. But I actually think that this is one of those things that is the same as 2,500 years ago when the Buddha taught. Because so much of the teachings has to do with being connected, reconnecting ourselves to the laws of nature, to inner nature, you know, to seeing true nature. That it sounds to me as if things were the same then, the mind was the same then. And so we can think, oh, we're in this modern world where there are so many distractions. You know, it's hard to live a natural kind of life with what is asked from us at times. And yet, at the same time, I don't think we should exaggerate this, because certainly it sounds as if the mind was basically the same 2,500 years ago. Now, and the medicine was the same as well. To be aware of how disconnected one is, you know, without taking it in any kind of personal way, to be aware of our disconnection. And then the medicine being that of mindfulness, reconnecting ourselves over and over again, even when we don't want to, even when there is resistance, reconnecting ourselves nonetheless. Another reason why it's so hard to remember to be mindful is because of the power of conditioning, which truly one needs to respect. You know, not to bow down to conditioning, but certainly to respect the power of conditioning, because it is extraordinarily strong. What happens in the practice is that when we begin, and please remember that begin can mean many years. There can be really many, 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 many years of beginning. You could say the first 10 years were beginning. Anyway, when we begin, it's as if awareness or mindfulness is very low and conditioning is very high. So conditioning is way up here and our capacity to be mindful is way down here. And then we practice, 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 and it changes. Conditioning is a little bit less. Mindfulness has helped to dissolve some of the conditioning, and the awareness, our capacity to be aware, is a little bit stronger. And then, you know, it becomes somewhat of an even situation where mindfulness can actually meet conditioning. You know, it's as strong as the conditioning is. And so it is possible for mindfulness to actually meet and allow for conditioning to dissolve. So this is a major part of what we're doing in our practice, is we're enlarging our capacity to be aware so that we have a chance to see the conditioning and to allow it to melt away, to allow it to dissolve. In the beginning, of course, the torments of heart overpower our capacity to be mindful. Gradually, our capacity to be mindful grows, and we're able to meet our conditioning with an inner sense of serenity and strength and willingness and actually interest and excitement. You know, instead of it being devastating when we see a habit, or when we see some place that we're really stuck, or when we see our conditioning, you know, instead of taking it so personally and seeing it as so devastating, it becomes, something quite interesting. You know, something that we can actually take on and work with and notice change occurring in our willingness to sustain our attention on the conditioning. This is somewhat where the breath comes in too, because in our willingness to be with the breath over and over again, we are actually strengthening our hearts. We are enlarging our ability to be with more of our life, more of our experiences. And so in this, we are able to be more aware. One question we might have is, why try to always be mindful? You know, why be continuous? We're asked to be continuous in our practice. Why be continuous? Why not take breaks and space out? You know, deliberately decide, oh, I've done this enough for today, and I think I'll just kind of cook up a good fantasy and enjoy that fantasy, and then I can refresh myself and come back to the present moment. It'll be there when I get back. Now, this is a good question. I was at the dentist some time ago, and he had this little comic on the side of his office door. It was of a dentist, because it was a dentist office, and a little boy. And there was a blurb over the little boy, and one of those blurbs over the dentist. And the little boy says to the dentist, "Do I have to floss all of my teeth? Yeah, all of them?" And the dentist says, "No, of course you don't. Just the ones you want to keep." So we do not have to be mindful. No one is demanding that we be mindful from moment to moment. You know, we are encouraged, certainly, invited, but no one is demanding that one be mindful from moment to moment. The question is, how many moments of our life do we want to live? You know, because when we deliberately take breaks, we take breaks anyway, and they're not deliberate, and these can't be helped. And this is how things are. It's not a problem. But when we deliberately cultivate getting lost, then we aren't living our life. There are moments when we are actually losing our life. And so living our life means being as continuous as we can. It's true that with wise effort and with wise intention, we won't always be able to be mindful. It's not going to happen. But intention and earnestness are really what matter. The intention to space out, when we actually form the intention to space out, it perpetuates suffering. Whereas mindfulness and wisdom dissolve the torments of heart. With mindfulness and with wisdom working together, we can see into the true nature of phenomena. And in seeing into the true nature of phenomena, conditions have less of a chokehold over us. You know? Both inner conditions as well as outer conditions have less of a hold over us. And we find peace in the midst of whatever it is that's occurring. As I said before, this practice is also called the practice of recollection because we are recollecting ourselves. In a sense, as we practice, we're coming into wholeness. We are reclaiming what we have lost, what we have forgotten. And you could say that we're moving out of fragmentation and into a sense of wholeness. It's a gathering together. Our energies are generally quite dispersed and all over the place because we find ourselves so distracted. Now, but in sustaining our practice as best as we're able to, there is an organic and natural gathering together that takes place. You could say that we're moving from a mind that is scattered to a mind that is concentrated and steady. it really naturally moves into an inner steadiness. You could also say that we're moving from spaciness into spaciousness. Yeah. Most of the time we start off being quite spacey. I mean, I can just speak for myself, but probably for some of you this is true as well. We start with a mind that is very spacey, and we move into a spaciousness of mind. When we begin to practice, as we practice, we find usually a great deal of inner chaos. We find that our desires and our longings and our pleasures and our pains and our aversions are all colliding in there. Now, and this is why it can sometimes feel excruciating. And one is wondering, where's the peace that I've heard about? You know, because we're really just experiencing this inner chaos, this inner colliding. When the mind is crowded and congested, it's like being lost in thickets. You know, we just don't know where we are, and we just don't know what is happening. Some years ago, I was practicing in England, in Devon. I was sitting a three-month retreat by myself, a self-retreat, at a retreat center called Gaia House. And I had this experience very vividly of hedges or thickets obscuring me, my vision. I took a walk every day on this retreat. And I don't know if some of you know this area of the world, Devon, but it's really quite beautiful. The sky is very spacious, and the clouds feel like you can just touch them if you put your hand up. And the woods are really quite luminous and quite beautiful. It's an area, at least the area that I was in, of farmland. And there are very, very narrow roads and a lot of very tall hedges. The roads are so narrow that usually cars have to back up to let another car go. Sometimes they have to back up quite a bit so that another car can go. So everybody has to cooperate. So very thin roads and very, very high hedges. And these hedges, you know, I was really quite taken by them. It's almost like you're in a maze at times. And they're very romantic looking, and I don't know, I like them quite a bit until this one day. So I was walking, my usual walk, and I began to walk up quite a high hill. And I was about halfway up the hill, very narrow road, very high hedges. I was about halfway up the road, walking in pretty much a contemplative way. I was really enjoying myself and lifting, moving, placing, enjoying the foot touching the floor and the ground and the air around me and the sky, and it was really quite a nice walk. So I was halfway up the hill, and all of a sudden, just extremely suddenly, at the top of the hill, I see a million cows. Start to come running right towards me down the hill. You know, headlong, no restraint in the actions of these cows, just extremely headlong right at me. Really big cows. And as I said, the roads are quite narrow, so the cows were filling the entire road, running right at me. I had to think really quick. I thought, well, you know, I can't outrun them. That was the first thought I had, is maybe I can outrun them. But I was halfway up, and they were running right at me really quickly. I'd never seen cows run this fast. But they were running very, very fast right at me, four abreast or five abreast or whatever, filling up the road completely. So I thought, no, I can't outrun them. And then I thought, my goodness, you know, maybe I could throw myself on top of a hedge. Now, these hedges look quite romantic and quite nice, but when you look closely, which some of you may know, hedges are actually made up of sticks that are pointed. No? So many sticks that are pointed, bound together. Plus, you know, so if I threw myself on top of the hedge, it would be pretty much suicidal. Plus, I'm not all that athletic. I would have had to find a pole and, you know, pole vault on top of the hedge. So, not possible. So, you know, pretty much I was thinking it's all over, prepare to die. You know, I was at least thinking, well, I'm in the saddle. I'm going to die in the saddle because I'm on a retreat. So, it's you know, it's had a good life. It's you know, it's just time. But when one is in this kind of situation, you know, odd things kind of happen. You do kind of odd things because you don't know what to do. So I decided I wasn't just going to stand in the middle of the road and let the cows mow me down. I moved to the side a bit, and I did have one thought that it would kind of be like Popeye and olive oil, you know, that I would try to make myself super thin and just lean against the hedge, you know. But that really wouldn't have worked either because of the sharp sticks pointing out, and also the fact that there's no way these cows could go around me. So, just out of my mouth and just quite spontaneously, you know, somewhat desperate, I said something to the cows. And I can't actually remember exactly what I said, but it was something along the lines of, you know, oh, nice cows. please go around me, or something along those lines. This came out of my mouth, and I didn't really say it very loudly. I was really just talking to the cows. This came out of my mouth. All of a sudden, the cows stop. You know, they're midway down the hill. They were at the top. I was in the middle. They're half by half closer to me. All of a sudden, these cows completely come to a standstill. And I'm thinking, what in the world is happening? I had this moment of real delusion. You know, that was part faith, blind faith, and part grandiosity, thinking that I had made the cows stop. You know, that I had actually said, nice cows, and so they had stopped. I had just a brief moment of remembering this story in the Buddhist time where he had sent an elephant, a deranged elephant, metta, loving kindness, and the elephant stopped and bowed down. So I had this super deluded moment. And, you know, alas, and of course, this wasn't what happened. What I noticed is that after the cows stopped, the cows started to walk again quite slowly. They weren't running this time. They were walking in quite a deliberate and, you know, I thought quite nice way. And as they came over the crest of the hill, I noticed that there was a man behind the cows who had total control over them, you know, to say go or stop or walk slowly or whatever. And I didn't stick around to ask. I mean, I did just hightail it out of there once I noticed that they were walking and not running and there was a guy there. But I assumed that this man must have heard me and told the cows to stop. But, you know, it was this situation of not being able to see and so being quite deluded because I couldn't see, because of the hedges around me and because of the hill. It wasn't possible for me to see my true situation. So when are, the point of the story is that when we are inwardly in chaos, you know, when there are hedges, high hedges in our minds, when everything is colliding within and we can't see, we don't know what our true situation is. We believe it anyway. Oftentimes, most of the time, just the way I did about these cows, most of the time, we simply believe that what we see is so, obviously. Yeah? But when we look more deeply and we notice how chaotic it can be in there, one wonders why we would believe it. Yeah? And so part of our practice, to some extent, is suspending our belief. You know, and allowing things to clear out some, allowing, I don't know, the hedges to shorten or the hill to flatten or something to happen so that there is more spaciousness, so that we can see our true situation more clearly. Recollecting doesn't mean solidifying around I am. You know, I am this or I am that. In no way does it mean making our experiences concrete. It's actually an encouragement of a beginner's mind, a mind that doesn't know, a mind that is open to learning. I'd like to read you something by Mary Oliver called Daisies. It is possible, I suppose, that sometime we will learn everything there is to learn, what the world is, for example, and what it means. I think this as I am crossing from one field to another in summer, and the mockingbird is mocking me as one who either knows enough already or knows enough to be perfectly content not knowing. Song being born of quest, he knows this. He must turn silent were he suddenly assaulted with answers. Instead, hear his wild caustic tender warbling, ceaselessly unanswered. At my feet, the white-petaled daisies display the small suns of their centerpiece, their, if you don't mind my saying so, their hearts. Of course, I could be wrong. Perhaps their hearts are pale and narrow and hidden in the roots. What do I know? But this, it is heaven itself to take what is given, to see what is plain, what the sun lights up willingly. For example, I think this as I reach down, not to pick but merely to touch, the suitability of the field for the daisies and the daisies for the field. Remembering and recollecting is a rediscovery of that which is most beautiful within us. The Buddha didn't create liberation. He rediscovered it. And he rediscovered it by paying attention, by listening and observing the laws of nature and recognizing that they weren't outside of him. You know, that the laws of nature are within and are not random, are not haphazard. The Buddha pointed the path out, and now all we need to do is to walk it. May all beings have ease of mind. May all beings have comfort of heart. May all beings live in love and in compassion. Can we sit for just a moment?